Good afternoon. You're listening to KFSK Public Radio in Petersburg. I'm Joe Bicknicki with the local news. After two canceled meetings this week, Petersburg's Borough Assembly met this morning and approved two emergency laws approving their continued meeting by teleconference. The Assembly for the Municipal Government has been meeting by phone since mid-March because of the COVID-19 pandemic, but it turns out a temporary suspension of local law that requires in-person meeting expired at the end of April. Borough law requires at least four assembly members meeting in person. Others can participate by phone, but normally are not counted toward that four-person minimum or quorum. That requirement was waived by the assembly in an emergency ordinance passed March 16th. Staff in the assembly did not realize it had expired until this week, and that prompted the cancellation of yesterday's rescheduled meeting. Petersburg Mayor Mark Jensen explained the two emergency laws up for vote today.
The first ordinance we will adopt actually is retroactive. It goes back a few months because just a little misunderstanding on things. And then the next ordinance will be to move us forward with being able to be counted as a quorum, part of a quorum if you're calling in on a phone. So
the Assembly in June approved an extension of a local health mandate for public participation by phone in meetings, while allowing for assembly members to choose between in-person or phone attendance. At the same time, they also approved a meeting policy that acknowledges continue meeting by phone. Borough Clerk Debbie Thompson writes in an email, "The borough does not believe actions taken on the phone by the assembly during the last 2 months are invalid." This morning's meeting also had a different call-in number than advertised because of a scheduling mistake by the phone company. Assembly member Jeff Mucci wanted to ensure that public comment on these emergency ordinances would still be taken by the borough. Clerk Thompson encouraged the public to continue sending in comment to the assembly by email.
If there were people that had wanted to speak and tried to call in, I will encourage them to send the email. I suppose that if there is a lot of controversy over these two ordinances, which I truly hope there isn't, but if there is, then we could always decide to readdress them at another meeting.
And the vote was 6-0 to approve both emergency ordinances, with Assemblymember Brandy Marole not attending the meeting this morning. They only require one reading before taking effect. The second ordinance approved another 60 days of teleconference meetings, and the Assembly will have to extend that if they want. And it means meetings of the Assembly likely will continue mostly by phone this summer. And the Assembly has now rescheduled its first regular meeting of the month to next Wednesday, July 15th at noon. That meeting includes the second reading and public hearing for a permanent ordinance on the borough's emergency response powers and responsibilities. KFSK will broadcast that live. At least one small cruise ship company will not sail in Alaska this summer. American Cruise Lines announced Tuesday it has canceled its season due to a spike in COVID-19 cases in other parts of the country. That company is one of a handful with ships that are not subject to federal and international restrictions on larger ships with 250 passengers or more. Norwegian Cruise Line was the last major cruise ship company with tentative plans to visit Alaska this season, but it ended the suspense Monday, canceling its few remaining sailings on the schedule. Smaller cruise lines offered one potential way to salvage some business amid the pandemic, even though their passengers represent a very small portion of the 1.4 million passengers expected to visit this year. According to the most recent email update from Tourism Best Management Practices in Juneau, three other small cruise ship companies could still visit southeast port communities. That email Monday said the Sitka-based Alaskan Dream Cruises suspended sailings until the end of July, and National Geographic hopes to resume sailings in mid-August. Dan Blanchard, owner of Juneau-based Uncruise Adventures, said in an email they plan to start sailing August 1st. Passengers would fly in and out of Juneau, and those ships would not stop in other communities. Visits from small ships have been a subject of debate this summer and spring. Ketchikan Assembly had voted to allow an American Cruise Lines ship to dock in July, and this week the Skagway Assembly asked them not to come. A company also had reached out to Petersburg about dockings this summer, but again has canceled for the season. A relatively new technique for dating rock is being used here in Southeast Alaska, and it's rewriting the area's geologic and possibly anthropologic history. While it's understood that ice likely covered most, if not all, of the islands and mainland of the current-day Alexander Archipelago, it now appears to have retreated from parts of the panhandle thousands of years earlier than scientists originally thought. Here's more in this report.
Tens of thousands of years ago, the Cordilleran ice sheet covered the western edge of Canada and parts of Alaska, including the southeast panhandle.
At 17,000 years ago, you can imagine there was a really thick, basically a wall of ice that was covering, we think, most of the region at that time.
That's Aliyah Lesnick, now a postdoctoral scholar at the University of New Hampshire.
But by 15,000 years ago, most of the region was ice-free. There may have been some small glaciers up on high elevation mountain summits in sort of the inland part of southeast Alaska, east of Ketchikan. But places like Ketchikan and Wrangell, they were all completely ice-free by 15,000 years ago. So it was a pretty dramatic change.
Lesnick was the lead author on a research paper published this year. It was her PhD research through the University at Buffalo, a graduate student-led project with cooperation by the U.S. Forest Service. Researchers used a new method of dating the rock, which measures chemical changes from cosmic radiation. Those changes happen over time as the surface of the rock is exposed to the atmosphere. Lesnick and others used the technique to focus on the western part of this region in findings published in 2018. This latest work looked at the ice retreat farther inland. Another author on the paper, Jason Briner, is a geology professor at the University at Buffalo and Lesnick's advisor on her doctoral studies. He's done other research in southeast Alaska, where the contemporary rainforest vegetation makes it difficult to find the right samples of ancient rock.
It's been a very challenging place to do field work, and for that reason, the history of the Ice Age and the ice sheet fluctuations during the Ice Age historically aren't known very well in southeast Alaska compared to other parts of the world that had ice sheets.
The rock dating technique has allowed scientists to push back dates of the beginning of the ice-free areas in southeast to around 17,000 years. Older ice-free zones have yet to be found, but Briner says they're still looking. Human migration and settlement of the area may have depended on absence of the ice.
We were expecting to see some landscapes that are quite old that would have been available for human migration long ago, even during the Ice Age, and the oldest landscapes we could find dated to about 17,000, and it seems like the ice sheet may have covered all of the southeast Alaska archipelago, although that's a problem we're still working on.
The oldest human remains discovered in the region date back to 10,300 years ago. Those were found in a small cave on Prince of Wales Island in 1996. But because of sea level rise since the end of the Ice Age, traces of the oldest humans in this part of the world may be deep underwater. Animal bones have also been found in that cave from well before and well after the ice sheet may have covered it. Jim Bechtel is forest geologist for the Forest Service on the Tongass National Forest. He and former Tongass employee Alex Lyles also worked on this project.
I think one of the really fun aspects of this research has been when I first moved to southeast Alaska in 1990, everything that was written said we were a blanket of ice to the edge of the continental margin until 10,000 years ago. You know, and this is just the discoveries in the caves and other research and stuff like that has changed that as we move through time. And then this has really pushed it back, saying that, you know, there was exposed land and opening starting at about 17,000 years ago, much, much sooner than we'd thought.
Bechtel is hopeful that not all evidence of ancient human migration is underwater. He thinks there could be sites like Kruzoff Island near Sitka that simply haven't been found. This deep dive into Alaska's geologic past has relevance for the present. Aliyah Lesnick says southeast glacial history could provide insights into present-day ice caps.
And we had these oscillations between kind of very cold climate states similar to an ice age and warm climate states that are similar to now that were happening every 2,000 years, roughly. And the fact that the Cordilleran ice sheet reacted so quickly and so dramatically to one of these warm climate states really highlights that these ice sheets that are in contact with the ocean are very sensitive to climate change. And so that really can help put into context some of the modern changes that we're seeing in places like Antarctica and in Greenland.
And once the ice recedes, colonization by plants and animals begins. Ongoing research in Southeast Alaska will tie together that geologic history with the DNA left behind by life forms that moved in soon after.
From large-scale ice to a little smaller scale, a glacial dam release in the Juneau ice field caused the Taku River to swell over the holiday weekend. The National Weather Service issued a flood advisory July 4th when a river gauge at the Canadian border showed water levels rapidly rising. That river peaked at around 2 o'clock the next morning, July 5th. Senior hydrologist Aaron Jacobs says water temperatures dropped and river flow doubled. Jacobs says there was no reports of damage or injuries from cabin owners or anyone recreating along the Taku River. There have been glacial dam releases called eokalups into the Taku River in previous years. Jacobs says they're usually caused by frequent damming of Lake No Lake by the Tulsiqua Glacier. Jacobs says this release is a little smaller than previous ones, and a second release this summer is still likely. Authorities say they've seized another parcel stuffed with narcotics in the U.S. mail in Ketchikan. That's according to a Wednesday statement from Ketchikan's police department. Postal inspectors reportedly intercepted a package of methamphetamines and cocaine bound for a Park Avenue residence last Thursday. Ketchikan police say Alaska State Troopers' drug dogs helped sniff out the parcel, which they say contained half a pound of methamphetamine and a small amount of cocaine. Ketchikan resident Anthony Love faces two felony counts of drug possession with intent to distribute. He was released on his own recognizance, pending a court appearance, according to Ketchikan police. In the state's prisoner database, it's the second case of someone allegedly receiving large amounts of illegal drugs in the mail in that community in a two-week period. Most coastal residents have heard about paralytic shellfish poisoning and the dangers it can pose to humans, but it's not just people that can get sick or even die from eating toxic mussels, clams, or other shellfish. As Aaron McKinstry reports, pet owners need to watch out for their dogs as well.
Naomi Bargman leans over the edge of the Stargavin dock to dip a frosted plastic bottle attached to a net into the cold waters of Sitka Sound. Her Alaskan husky, Chickie, lounges on the dock beside her.
Chickie's not very good at helping, but
she's doing something called a plankton tow. Her lab conducts one once a week to get a snapshot of what's going on with the water's microscopic life.
So, the most important thing is make sure you don't lose the bottle. Make sure it's screwed on tightly. Throw it in the water. Try to get some water in the bottle so it sinks. Do that again. And then, one more time. And we're going to let it go to its watery grave at the bottom.
Bargman works as an environmental lab specialist for the Sitka Tribe of Alaska. They opened a lab in 2016 to monitor for harmful toxins that cause paralytic shellfish poisoning, or PSP. What Bargman's doing today helps track harmful algal blooms that can produce those toxins. Blooms can serve as an early warning sign for people who harvest shellfish or pet owners with shellfish-loving dogs.
Fortunately, we haven't seen the harmful algal species in high concentrations lately.
The lab also tests shellfish directly and has a free testing program for Sitkins. Bargman says about 80% of the butter clams they've tested since September have been over the FDA limit.
Butter clams, I like to say that they don't know how to socially distance themselves from PSP, because once they get high levels of PSP, they tend to hang on to them for months to even years.
A dog was recently hospitalized after eating a clam at South Stargavin Beach. Dr. Tokoa Wolf from Sitka Animal Hospital treated the sick puppy.
Really, the only thing you can do is the tincture of thyme, supporting them through the toxicity if it's severe. Sometimes that means giving them nausea medication, IV fluids, warming them if they're having difficulty keeping their temperature up, and monitoring their heart rate, because it can cause a very fast heart rate.
Dr. Wolf started practicing in Sitka last August. Since then, she's heard of about 4 suspected cases from other vets in town. but this is the only one she's treated here where the dog had a known history of eating shellfish. She says most dogs make a full recovery by the next day, including the one she treated. Initial signs of PSP in a dog include unstable walking, excessive drooling, weakness, and vomiting.
I would say the most important thing is, you know, not to panic. It doesn't mean that, you know, your dog can't take a nice casual walk on the beach. It's something to be aware of. If you see the signs, it's good to get to a veterinarian.
Because it could be something else that needs to be treated. And even though it's rare, dogs can die from PSP, just like people.
It can progress to muscle paralysis and even respiratory depression, or difficulty breathing, and there has been reports of pets having to be put on a ventilator to see through it.
It's not like below tide this week.
Okay.
After completing the plankton tow, Naomi Bargman takes her pup for a walk along North Stargaven Beach. Recently, the lab found high levels of PSP in a butter clam just south of here, on the other side of the creek, the same place where the dog Dr. Wolf treated got sick. As Chicky roams with her nose to the ground, Bargman doesn't keep too close of an eye. She's not much of a shellfish eater.
Fortunately for me, I'm not that worried, you know. She eats other disgusting things instead.
But for dog owners whose pets are into digging up and munching shellfish, the best thing they can do is keep them on a leash at the beach and keep watch for local advisories. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Erin McKinstry.
And for KFSK News, I'm Joe Vicnicki.